that we bow our heads as we calm ourselves and bring ourselves into the presence, the knowledge that will be bestowed today. Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for the opportunity to gather here today as we join amongst friends, new friends, old friends, as we delve into the knowledge that has been imparted by me today through your will. We know that it's not my will, but thine be done. And if we ask anything according to your will, if we ask it, it will be done. We ask that you guide us, guard our hearts, allow us to put on our full armor of faith today as we embark upon this day. We want to thank you for the opportunity to delve and to grow and to learn. And these things we ask in Jesus' name we pray, amen. So I will share my screen as we get started today, and it's a delight to present to you on the topic of the color of COVID. And I think that you'll be remarkably surprised by some of the information. I tried to make sure that the information that I have today is relevant as of today. So there will be some information that is just that was just reported as of last night and of this morning. So I wanted to make sure that the slides were current. And I want to thank you so much, Ted, for the kind introduction and the opportunity to speak today on the color of COVID. So in an academic speech, I give my disclosures, which will not be relevant to the content of this talk. I serve as an advisor for GoodRx, Calibrate, and Novo Nordisk, and I also receive research funds from Amazon, but this will not be relevant to today's presentation. So we have a few objectives today, and they are as follow. We're going to explore the prevalence of COVID-19 in minority and majority groups here in the United States. We'll explore the interrelationship of COVID-19, obesity, inflammation in majority groups, but also in racial and ethnic minority groups. And I think we'll explore the continuum, the life continuum associated with these issues. And then finally, we'll discuss strategies to mitigate the severity of COVID-19 in racial and ethnic minorities, particularly those with obesity. And as Ted mentioned, my specialty is as an obesity medicine physician and scientist here at Mass General and at Harvard Medical School. So this information as current, as of right now, you can see that the date that is noted here is January 16th. So I took this off yesterday to make sure that this was updated for the slide set. When we're looking at the United States COVID-19 cases and deaths by state, you can see the total number of cases, over 23 million cases, average daily cases per 100,000 in the last 7 days, 68.7, and the total deaths, unfortunately, and I'm sure this number would be different if I had pulled this off this morning, over 390,000. I think we probably could say about 391,000, along with 3,686 deaths as of yesterday. So if we didn't believe that this was real, if we didn't believe that this was affecting our lives, the way we operate, the way that we commune, the way that we conduct ourselves in places of worship, I think that we can all indeed say that this is definitely not the case. As we look at these numbers as the biggest pandemic, acute pandemic to affect our lives. When we look at the US COVID-19 average daily case rate in the last 7 days, and like I said, I pulled this off yesterday. I wanna focus obviously for you, the Westminster congregation on Pennsylvania. You can see us up in Massachusetts up here, but you can see that this is the average daily cases per 100,000. So the darkening of the color means worse. Obviously certain states like my home state of Georgia, we've heard a lot about California, but we can see New York State has arisen to having really high case rates per in the last 7 days. But no one's really out of the woods, and it's important for us to recognize that. Now, I have to get a little bit scientific-y, right? I just made up a word. But we have to delve into the science of how this novel coronavirus works. And I won't spend a lot of time going through the nuances, but I do want to just explain some information about how this virus does enter the body. So it's important to recognize that you can see SARS-CoV-2, which is severe acute respiratory syndrome, coronavirus 2. There are spike proteins that enter and engulfed into a host cell by the angiotensin converting enzyme receptors. So it basically kind of pulls it in. And when that happens, we see this activation of different things. We see angiotensinogen being converted to Ang-1 and Ang-2. But we see this downstream inflammation that really happens is that macrophage or macrophage, however you'd like to say it, then puts off these inflammatory cytokines. Think of these as inflammation in the body. And we see TNF-alpha, IL-1, MMP-1 and 3, a host of inflammatory markers leading to what we call ARDS, or acute respiratory distress syndrome, and macrophage activating syndrome. So there's this inflammation that's colliding within the body by all of the mechanisms. I told you I'm not going to go into all of the nuances of what we see here, but this shows you the complexity of what happens when SARS-CoV-2, or what we also know as COVID-19, infects our bodies. But when we talk about the color of COVID, and we're going to talk about this across majority and minority groups today, it's important for us to recognize that this disease, this virus, in many ways has disproportionately infected the Black, Latinx community and those that are Native American, although the data that we have on the Native American population is indeed sparse. Let's look at this April data, and you might be like, well, gosh, what was happening back in April? That seems so far ago. But in April of 2020, if you're looking at COVID-19 and the impact in major states and cities, you can see here that the share of COVID-19 deaths from African Americans in Louisiana was about 70% of the deaths, 42% in Illinois, 41% in Michigan. North Carolina, you can see 22%, but keep in mind the population of African-Americans is about hovering somewhere between 13 to 14% of the population here in the United States. In Chicago, we can see here that disproportionately impacting African-American communities. And as we look at racial disparities, COVID-19 deaths, and this is now a little bit further, July 30th, 2020, and looking at the different racial and ethnic groups, although you'll see some newer information as we come further into the presentation, that if we're looking at Black or African American individuals like myself, we're looking at higher rates of racial disparities in conjunction with the percentage of population. Look at American Indians, Alaskan Natives. I told you we have minimal data, but we do have some data coming out of Statista here. Hispanic or Latinx community. Then we have the Asian population, white population. Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders tend to be less affected. It is slightly less havoc in Hawaii, but it's important for us to know that there are some disparities that we can indeed say are prevalent as we're looking at COVID-19. Now, what I wanted to do, I told you, was to bring up, you know, the most recent data. And so if you were to go and do a perusal of the CDC site as of right now and look at what we're seeing in terms of age-adjusted COVID-19 hospitalization rates. Hospitalization, I want to bring up particularly because just because you're hospitalized doesn't mean obviously a death will occur. But let's look at the hospitalization rates from March to December of 2020 by the different groups. And what you can see here is that if we're looking at Hispanic, and this is the rate per 100,000 in the population, we can see that it's very high amongst Hispanic or Latinos. Non-Hispanic American Indian, very, very high, followed by non-Hispanic Black. And then we see this drop off here when we're looking at Asian or non-Hispanic Asians or Pacific Islanders, and then also non-Hispanic white population. So that hospitalization rate seems to be significantly lower when we look at it and those that do not fall in underrepresented racial groups. Now, I thought it was important for us to not just talk about what we're seeing in the general population, but in a population that disproportionately has high rates of individuals from the Black community, from the Latinx community, and look at what we're seeing in correctional and detention facilities throughout the United States. This is the overall data as of just this morning. I pulled this off, as you can see here, January 17th. I wanted this data to be current. And so what you can see is, you know, remember, keep in mind the total number of cases, the darker it is, the worse it is. So I want you guys to look over here, Pennsylvania, and see what we're seeing. I also wanted to highlight here, Pennsylvania, that you can see here, cases, deaths, and facilities. So they basically break this down by state and what we're seeing. I just think it's important to recognize that if we're looking at incarcerated populations here in the United States, 40 to 50% are Black men particularly. And so when we're looking at this, and while it doesn't have that racial ethnic lens that we're per se viewing this through, it's important for us to recognize who occupies our correctional and detention facilities. and look at what's happening there. Obviously, we can think about things such as safe distancing, right? Mask wearing, things of that sort, which we don't see happening in a population that is kind of forced to be in close confines. Now, I do want to bring up some data that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine. This comes from June of last year, and this was a study that came out. And this was looking at just a smaller cohort, 3,481 COVID-19 patients. And it was looking at, you know, different modeling one unadjusted, meaning they didn't take into several factors, model two using things such as age and sex in addition to race. And then in this more robust model, they looked at a lot of different things, race and age, sex. They looked at this thing called the Charlson Comorbidity Index, whether or not when someone lived in the lower income area, what type of insurance they had, Medicare, Medicaid versus commercial, and whether or not they had this disease of obesity that I am so passionate about. What you can see here is without adjustment, we can see that if you are a Black individual, you do have a higher risk of dying, about a 1.7 times higher likelihood. In that second model, you can see it goes up 2.35 once we add in this adjustment for age and sex. And then when we come to model three, almost still about twice likelihood of dying, once we build in all of these other, what we could say, social determinants of health and things of that sort, which build in like risk for dying and low income and insurance status. So you can see that there is something to be stated in terms of looking at this issue and how it truly impacts communities of color. They also looked at in this exact same this paper, hazard ratios for in-hospital deaths, really kind of looking at some of the things that you saw in that previous table, but in this one, getting a little bit more nuanced and looking at some of the clinical parameters, looking at respiratory rate or white blood cell count, kidney status, things of this sort, and inflammatory markers. You'll see the inflammatory markers being down here, CRP as a common one, procalcitonin, for example. And so when you start adjusting for these factors, now it's interesting that you actually see in this model four that accounts for all of those different factors, that when we compare Blacks and whites, for example, that we actually see that there is a lesser likelihood of dying when you combine all of these factors, particularly looking at these factors that are related to how someone's doing, whether they're in the ICU or inpatient in a regular room. And so there's some things to be said, and we'll see this idea or thought process revisited as we go throughout the presentation. Now, this is another paper. This came out slightly later in August of 2020 in Clinical Infectious Diseases. And this goes into some additional nuance. So I mentioned this idea of the ICU, looking at regular patient rooms, but let's look at those ICU admissions and the need for mechanical ventilation. And it breaks it down by men and women, and then who needs mechanical ventilation. I'm going to pay attention here that white is here in blue, Black in this orange color, and then Latinx in the gray color. So what we see if we look at ICU admission across the board, that Latinx individuals tend to have a higher likelihood of being admitted to the ICU, followed by white populations and then followed by Black. If we then go and look at mechanical ventilation, you can also see this consistent trend. Just pay attention to this gray bar where we're looking at the Latinx population having a higher need for both ICU admission and for mechanical ventilation. It's also important for me to point out with these p-values, that these results are indeed significant. We can see that this bores out whether we're looking at men or women in both ICU populations and in those that require mechanical ventilation. In this actual same paper, we're now looking at mortality, not just whether or not they needed to go to the ICU or needed mechanical ventilation. We're looking at actually who dies. So when we talked about who gets admitted, who has the disease, we talked about the disproportionate impact and burden on communities of color. But what you'll see from this data is that when we're looking at white individuals, we actually have a much higher mortality rate in COVID-19 in this particular study. You can see that bores out both in men and in women. And when we're looking at white individuals compared to Black and Latinx. So remember, we saw Latinx needing to be admitted to the ICU, needing mechanical ventilation, but in terms of all-cause mortality, going down a smidge. Now, I do want to point out a few things when they try to divide this out by gender. Those p-values aren't significant. So we could maybe say there's some issues there. But once you look at the top line p-values, that for the most part, they are significant, particularly here in looking at overall mortality and mortality in men. So this information is taken from literally yesterday. I told you one of these slides to be current. So cases and deaths of COVID-19, this is based on current data. So as of January of 2021, what are we seeing? Now, when you look at these numbers, I want you to take this with a grain of salt. I do want to tell you that the CDC has struggled to get all of the racial ethnic breakdown in terms of the number of deaths. We saw over 390,000 right on that initial slide. And what I can tell you is that from this data taken from CDC, it seemed to capture about 240,000 individuals or so. So I just want to make sure that we take that into account. So this is cases, right? Cases in terms of the breakdown. It's important to note that white, non-Hispanic, obviously we have higher cases, higher population here in the United States. If we go and look at the Hispanic population representing, you know, close to what the actual number of Hispanic individuals here in the United States, the Black population being the next group. And then we see this drop off with Asians that are non-Hispanic, American Indians, and then those that have multiple races, like maybe of mixed race or things of that sort. Let's then contrast that to what we see here in actual deaths. So we have cases here, we have deaths here, and we want to look at what we're seeing. So white people are dying. You know, this idea that it's that this only is affecting communities of color is actually not quite true, as you can see here. We can see that white individuals are indeed of being affected by this. And so we can see that here. We can see that Black populations are disproportionately impacted. If we represent us at 13 or 14%, you know, we're still accounting for a higher percentage of deaths. Notice how there's that drop off, kind of a similar thing that we saw in that previous slide. So while we see the number of Hispanics, Latinos cases being relatively high, there's a drop off in terms of the percentage of deaths. And so something is, you know, protective in some way in the Hispanic population. Now I want to shift gears and talk about my favorite topic, because what we've seen is what we've seen borne out as we look at COVID-19 is we've seen this idea of certain disease factors playing a large role. And what one of the diseases that we've seen really play a large role is obesity. And the reason why this is because obesity is characterized by inflammation. So when we see inflammation, it's important for us to recognize that obesity as a disease is an inflammatory state. So when we began to see patients with obesity being disproportionately infected by SARS-CoV-2, right, COVID-19, which we saw when we looked at the mechanism producing these inflammatory cytokines being associated with inflammatory disorders, we can see that that would be problematic. So I want you to look here at this map of the United States. And I want us to look at the prevalence of obesity based upon self-report data from the BRFSS, which is the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. And this is data that's self-reported. And the reason why I'm saying self-reported and keep saying that is because we might think that self-report data is accurate, but we might not necessarily be truthful when we're giving our weight and height when someone asks us. So this is probably an underrepresentation of what we see in reality. So let's take some close looks. I want us to look at this because we're going to see this in a few subsequent slides. Those that have our self-report data states with less than 20% of obesity, we don't see that existing here in the United States based upon self-report data. A few states, and I'm actually, you know, obviously DC coming out here in green, Colorado also between 20 and 25%. When we look at here in yellow, 25 to less than 30% with regards to rates of obesity by self-report data. When we get into this oranging, which we see here in Pennsylvania, We can see here 30 to less than 35% prevalence of obesity. And then a lot of the Southeast, but including, you know, also obviously Michigan, Indiana, West Virginia, for example, greater than or equal to 35% prevalence of obesity when we look at the entire population, okay? Now let's break this down by race and ethnicity, and let's look at what we see in non-Hispanic white adults. What we can see here in non-Hispanic white adults is that the map changes, right? We see less reddening of the map, right? That higher rate of obesity by self-report. We see a little bit more greening. We start seeing Hawaii and DC getting less than 20% in terms of the prevalence of obesity by self-report data. Now I want to contrast that to the next slide that we'll see where we're looking at Hispanic adults. And what you can see here is we do see a bit more reddening of the country where we see higher prevalences of obesity, starting even up here in North Dakota, working our way down to Texas, for example. I want you also obviously pay close attention to your home state. I think it's always important to know what's going on in your own backyard. And so you can see here that Pennsylvania is orange here when we're looking at Hispanic adults. But the slide that brought me to the work that I do in obesity medicine is this next slide. When we look at non-Hispanic Black adults here in the United States, as a Black woman here in the United States, I am particularly keen on understanding the high degree of prevalence of overweight and obesity within the Black community. And so you can go back to your home state of Pennsylvania, but really any state, and see that their prevalence of obesity by self-report data is quite high based upon the current definitions that we have. I don't think we really like to live in Idaho. That's the only thing I can go from there. But then I do think we live in New Jersey. So it says insufficient data. So just something to note there. Now, I think that this is your county. If I'm wrong, I apologize, but I wanted to look up chronic conditions because chronic conditions do play a large role when we're looking at COVID-19. And so this is Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, particularly. And what we see here is that any chronic condition amongst the population, 41.7%, but these are the big ones that have borne out as issues in COVID-19. Chronic kidney disease has borne out as a major issue. 2.9% of the population in Allegheny County has kidney disease, COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, 6.8%. Heart disease, again, 6.8%. Those that actually have a diagnosis of diabetes, 10.3%. And then the disease that I am devoting my life to, obesity, 31.9% of the population in Allegheny County has this disease of obesity. So this overlap of the inflammation, right, associated with things like obesity is important. So this is giving you a little bit of a picture of what's going on in your backyard. So let's look at this idea of obesity and inflammation. So obesity leads to inflammation. It's a disease characterized by inflammation. And when we look at the disease process, it impairs what we call adipogenesis. That means the development of or breakdown of fat cells. Fat is adipose. When you hear that word adipose, that's what we're talking about. What we also see issues with oxidative stress, okay, in the fat tissue and in the vascular wall, so within the walls of our veins and things of that sort. We see insulin resistance, and this actually affects disease. So we start seeing diseases such as metabolic syndrome. Metabolic syndrome is likelihood of progression to things like type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes itself, we end up seeing. And then we see this prevalence of cardiovascular diseases, all associated with that cascade of obesity and inflammation, then leading to this downstream impact of other diseases that are quite prevalent within our society. So then I wanted to look at, as a pediatrician also, Mae failed to mention that I'm a pediatrician and an internist and an obesity medicine physician. So I take care of patients between the ages of 2 and 90. And it's important for me to begin to think about in the pediatric population, what are we seeing in terms of inflammation? That CRP, which stands for C-reactive protein, characterized by inflammation. And this is taken from NHANES data. NHANES is the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. And that data is actually based upon actual tangible data, not self-report data. So what I want you to see is that when we're looking at inflammation by child, race, and ethnicity, we're talking about children here. between the ages of 2 and 10, what we can see here is that if we're looking at non-Hispanic whites with U.S. born parents, that inflammation is 17%. But then let's contrast that to what we see in the Hispanic population, for example, where we see 26% here in the U.S. if they're U.S. born, 31% if they were born outside of the country. Let's come to, you know, African Americans, 22% if born here in the United States, 26% if there was a person that was born out of this country. And so we can see the difference in inflammation that may lead to this higher predilection for overweight and obesity, because that inflammation causes that storage of adipose or fat tissue. And what you can see here in this same article is that when they looked at predicted probabilities with modeling, and in these modeling, they initially just looked at issues surrounding like race, and then they began to escalate that by throwing in gender and also looking at issues such as insurance status. So this model for us, so the most robust model. So we'll focus on the most robust model. And what we can see here is that if you're looking at African-American, which will be here in the black or black speckled, foreign-born, high levels of inflammation. If you're looking at Hispanic, foreign-born, high levels. But then we can compare and contrast that to white. So across all models that are going to have lower levels of inflammation within the body and children. So this is the complex interplay of what we're seeing when we're looking at stress leading to issues such as obesity. So I'm not going to go through all of the pathways here, but you can see stress if it were traveling down, let's say path A, we could see unhealthy eating and lacks of exercise leading to issues with fatty food ingestion and dysphoria, leading to like intestinal wall leakiness and changes in the gut microbiome, which means the bacteria in one's gut. It affects our metabolism, leads to a change in what we call neuropeptides. So these are hormones that cause us to eat or store more. And you can see that every single pathway that we go down, stress is a major contributor to these disease processes that we see, obesity and metabolic syndrome, post-traumatic stress disorder and depression, that there is a major interplay of these things leading to issues like diabetes and cardiovascular disease. So, I mean, I could take about 30 minutes and go over that slide in detail, but we don't want to do that. This is some recent data coming out of the Proceedings of the National Academies of Science, and this shows life expectancy with COVID and without COVID at birth and at the age of 65. So I want us to look at this, and you can see that amongst the population, COVID-19 has affected our life expectancy regardless of our race or ethnicity. You can see that the overall life expectancy at birth has gone down with COVID-19 from 78.61 to 77.48. Amongst the Latino population, a major drop off from 81.82 to 78.77. The white population, you could see that maybe it's very close, but still there's a drop off. And in the black population, a bigger drop. Of course, blacks having the lowest life expectancy at birth. What happens at the life expectancy at the age of 65 in terms of number of years lost, you can see that there's a difference amongst all. Notice how that difference that we see in terms of life expectancy amongst the white population at birth and at the age of 65 does change. And this is in terms of life expectancy for years. So it's important for us to note these key things. What I want you to see here is trends in life expectancy at birth by race and ethnicity from 1980 until now, and see what's happened in all of the populations. So you can see that there has been a major drop off here. So this is what's expected. So this is projected, as you can see, with kind of these dotted lines here in blue and black, gray and orange. But we saw this kind of, for the most part, a genuine climb in life expectancy at birth. But that has been affected by COVID-19 in all populations. When we look at trends in racial and ethnic differences in life expectancy at birth, there is something called that Latino advantage. I told you guys I would revisit this idea of how the Latinx community appears to do better despite needing to go into the hospital, be admitted to the ICU, despite needing mechanical ventilation, that there appears to be a relative advantage to being of Hispanic origin. And there appears to be a disadvantage for being of a Black person here in the United States. So this is the difference in life expectancy at birth in terms of the Latino versus the Black community. You can see there's a drop off, still not back to baseline zero, making sure that you guys know that the baseline of zero is the white population, which is the comparator. And we can see that the Black disadvantage has only increased or, you know, are projected to increase with the advent of COVID-19. So let's look at this idea of like attributes to in and out group membership. And when we're talking about this in and out group membership, we're setting up the frameworks that, issues such as structural racism have led to inequities that we're seeing, particularly in the Black community as it relates to COVID-19. So when we look at the in group, which is typically the white population here in the United States, the in group is good, sacred, law-abiding, peacekeepers, trustworthy, good and caring leaders, civilized, innocent. When we get into those that are outside, typically the Black population, as we look at issues bubbling up in this country surrounding race, which have always been there but are becoming more prominently seen, the Black community be seen as evil, criminals. We talked about correctional facilities, hence my need to include that earlier. Brutal expansionists, untrustworthy, part of tyranny, primitive, guilty, offensive, oppressive, barbaric, profane. And so this idea of racism, sexism, ageism, ableism, homophobia, really is this attributes of those that are the in-group versus those that are the out-group. And when you set this dynamic up, it leads to inequities that are pervasive and actually bore out in health outcomes. I wanted to pull in this information from the Journal of Racial and Ethnic Health Disparities. This is just came out actually January of 2021. And this is based on publicly available data from all the way up until October 28th of 2020, looking at COVID-19 social determinants of health and race. And what they did was they evaluated certain clinical outcomes and looked at social determinants of health at the county level throughout the United States. And they found that counties with the higher death rates had a higher portion of Black residents, higher levels of adverse social determinants of health. And what you can see here is that they had a 1 percentage point increase in deaths associated with COVID when there were Black residents, uninsured adults of low birth weight, adults without high school diplomas, incarceration rate being high, without internet. You can see the numbers and the percentages of how they increased. So for example, low birth weight, boring out as being a major risk factors, along with, you know, incarceration rate being also very high in terms of looking at social determinants in those that have COVID and why we see some disproportionate outcomes. I wanted to focus on a paper that I published just in December of of 2020, looking at then, okay, so if we know that we're seeing disproportionate impact, that Black disadvantage, for example, what about if we tailored our messages differently to those individuals that are from Black and Latinx community? Does it matter? So this particular paper that came out in the Annals of Internal Medicine looked at whether or not tailoring COVID-19 public health messages by race and ethnicity actually improves knowledge and information seeking behavior in those from underrepresented groups, which you can see here in the study that we conducted in May of 2020. We had 14,267 Black and Latinx US adults. And what we can see is that each participant viewed 3 of 42 videos that varied by race and ethnicity of the messenger. So doctors that were either Black or white, and an acknowledgement of racism and community perceptions of things like mask wearing and COVID-19. What we found was that the knowledge improved after everyone watched these videos, but particularly within the Black community, Black but not Latinx participants, they only liked to receive the information that was being given or delivered if it was being presented by Black doctors like myself. I was one of the doctors that delivered the message. And so it's important to recognize this idea of trust as we begin to investigate historical prejudices that may have led to some distrust of the greater community. But also this idea that when I deliver that message to my community, that it will be well received. And that's what our study showed. So when we look at disparities, obesity and COVID-19, it's important to recognize that there are a lot of different reasons why we see this. There's issues with economic status. There's issues with underlying health conditions, household crowding, pathophysiologic differences in inflammation, which we talked about, that we see as early as childhood, starting at the age of 2 years of age, differences in this, which lead to disproportionate impacts in communities, particularly the Black community. And so, you know, The Lancet, there was a great piece that came out that kind of really tried to look at this. So it's looking at genomically determined response to viral pathogens. In this particular case, we're talking about the viral pathogen that is SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19. So if we look at overall health state, you know, if we're looking at comorbidity control, like diseases associated, like such, we talk about kidney status, we talk about heart disease, we talk about lung status and comorbidity burden, how that affects differently for different communities. We talked about just a few moments ago, even with the study that I had that came out, looking at education and understanding about COVID-19, English language and proficiency being part of the health behaviors, along with general consulting patterns and health access, health-seeking behavior, recognizing that these things may be compromised, particularly in the Black community. Social behaviors, how frequently are people socializing? What is that intergenerational interaction and how does that then predispose or not predispose one to certain risk factors? Interactive behaviors and gatherings, interactions with the unwell. So if you're particularly, for example, a member of the Black community, do you have to interact more with a community that would be unwell, which then increases your risk for the disease and potential subsequent death? So when we look at COVID-19 and race and ethnicity, it's important to recognize that obesity and ethnicity are additive, multiplicative, mediators or confounders, and the degree to which obesity increases the risk independent from its many comorbidities have significant implications for our medical and public health response. So when we're thinking about COVID-19, when we're thinking about any disease process, but COVID-19 has risen to the level of awareness that we began to think about the complexity that is associated with the complex interplay of structural racism, inequity, social determinants of health, that we think about these in the context of obesity, for example, which is characterized by inflammation, but think about the special impact on communities of color as we look at the disparities that exist between these different populations. And I want to thank you for your time. So I wanted to leave a robust amount of time for information. Here is my information. I'm Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford, and I want to thank the Westminster Presbyterian Church, Ted Kyle, Sarah Kyle, et cetera, for having me today to present. And I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Fatima. That was an amazing amount of information. I'm sitting here thinking, boy, I'm glad we're recording this because I'm going to want to listen to this a couple times. But I'm interested in, you know, others can jump in as soon as possible, but I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about the advantage in life expectancy for Latinx communities and how people think about this and what is the significance of it? Where does that come from? How do we explain that?
You know, that's an amazing question, Ted, like looking at this idea of that Hispanic advantage, right, in life expectancy. We're not quite sure. And what makes that a little bit more challenging to evaluate the answer to that question is the fact that when we're looking at the Hispanic population, you know, when you're teasing it out, we have persons that identify as Black Hispanic versus those that identify as white Hispanic. And when you bring together this really kind of conglomerate of individuals that may come from different Hispanic origins, maybe they were born and raised in Mexico, maybe they were actually born and raised in Latin America. Where are they coming from? What is their background? It kind of smushes everything together. So I think that maybe that advantage comes from the variety of what we see within the admixture that is the Hispanic population. It hasn't been really well, it's not really well understood. We know it exists, but we don't really understand why. But I think that's one of the explanations that has been posited as to why we see that.
It's just really striking. So for others, I want to encourage you to unmute your microphones if you'd like and ask any questions? I know there's just a whole lot of
I see a question in the chat, or a few questions I'm going to try to answer. I think people like to type, so I'm glad I can read fast. So Kathy, is the PowerPoint available? I will make the PDF of the slides available to Ted after the talk is completed. So if you want to go back and look at what's included, I'll make sure that's available, Kathy.
That's great, Kathy. Fatima, and I'll mention that the recording of this session will be posted on the church's website with all the other seminars. And alongside that, we can post that PDF that you're so graciously offering. And we
absolutely.
I appreciate that very much. The reason that I have asked is I think your work is just absolutely outstanding. And I would love my bariatric surgeon to see this. And the reason is because I have already gone to him once or twice, but I think maybe this will push him over the edge, and asked him if he would come forward to our community and talk to our community about getting their shot, getting our community trusts him.
Right.
And, people have their own hangups, whether it be political or for whatever reason.
Right.
But if he would come forward and say, we all need to get vaccinated because they trust him. And I think if he could read your paper and read what you wrote, I think after a while that, I can say so much, but I haven't done your work.
Right. So what, Kathy, so I'm willing also to share, the PDF of that paper, for example,
Thank you.
I think is really, not just because I helped write it. I really think the work was quite novel because we actually went. And when we looked at those Black and Latinx individuals, particularly, we were looking at those that had a high school education or less. Mm-hmm. So we weren't looking at people like me that was working on their fifth degree. I don't think that would be an adequate comparison. The health behaviors and health seeking behaviors of the population that represents me, it's very different, right? So it's important to recognize that we were really thoughtful and mindful about that. And also what I think was important when you look at just the team of investigators with that paper is that it was a very multidisciplinary group. Two Nobel laureates actually are on that work, Abhijit Bajaji and Esther Duflo, who's the senior author, both Nobel Prize recipients in economics just a few years ago. So we were thinking about the economic piece. I was there for the medical piece of the puzzle. They brought together really thought leaders, Marcella Eslan. The two of us were first authors. Both of us are MDs, but her work is in policy directly at the Kennedy School. She does no practice of medicine. So we were putting our minds together to think of how do we communicate that? And I said, the key thing I thought, and this is one of the things I thought about with the group, was looking at who is delivering the message, who will hear the message, who will receive the message. And so I think that's important. So Kathy, thanks so much for bringing that up. And I agree, having those people that are respected and used to being heard within the community is extremely important.
It is. Thank you. That was an excellent, excellent hour. Fabulous. Thank you.
Absolutely. I see. I'm with you, Ted. I know. See, I'm reading your mind. I think you're telling me there's other questions. I'm looking. I got you. A. David Paul. Thank you for thinking this information is fascinating and informative. You're absolutely right. When we're looking at this issue of structural racism, how that plays a role in health outcomes, we cannot ignore this. For so many years, we've been doing it. And I see healthcare organizations, including my own, really struggle and grapple with how to tackle it. I think one of the key issues is they're not using the right people that really kind of can think about these things in a concerted fashion to really lead to sustainable change. And so that's problematic. But I think that there are at least the intents there now for the first time. So we do have a potential to see growth. So thank you so much. Carol Galbraith, she says, I think we saw that men versus women had a higher likelihood. Absolutely. I kind of scooted over that, but you were paying attention, Carol. Higher likelihood of ICU and mechanical ventilation, but a similar likelihood of death. Was that significant? So actually what we're seeing is that men are more likely to die when you look at the bigger data. So that particular study looked at close to 4,000 individuals, but men appear to have a higher risk of dying from COVID when we control for gender across all of the studies that are now published. So Carol, does that answer your question specifically? I don't know if Carol's listening. If not, Carol,
Yeah, yes, a lot of people have stayed muted, but you can feel free to unmute your microphone if you want to ask a question.
Yes, thank you. That was helpful. I had thought that they were similar in the death rate, and I thought then, you know, why aren't the women getting into ICU or getting mechanical ventilation if it seems to be, you know, why do they have less instance of that? But
remember, that's one study. The one thing that we don't have a lot of yet, Carol, is these big meta-analyses where we pull together all the studies and see like what we see across the board. But some of the meta-analysis data that has been performed kind of shows that there is a higher risk of dying if you are of a male gender overall, regardless of whether or not you get ICU attention or admission or the need for mechanical ventilation based upon your respiratory parameters.
Interesting, thanks.
Absolutely. Peter, I see, it says, looks like there was some good news of life expectancy of African-Americans from 1980 until the advent of COVID. Yes. So before COVID, it seemed like we were gaining some ground. Although, Peter, if you look at the data, we were still significantly below other groups. And all of the data that are presented, if you were Black here in the United States, our life expectancy is lower. There have even been studies, and I didn't present this work because it wasn't particularly relevant to this, but I think as we're looking at controlling for socioeconomic status, there was a large study done of Yale medical school graduates looking at life expectancy amongst Yale medical school graduates by race and gender. And they found that Black doctors that were graduating from Yale, a respectable school, I think we would say, also still show that significant difference in life expectancy. So obviously we've controlled for socioeconomic factors when you're looking at all physician cohort, but still seeing those differences that bore out in the population, regardless of that controlling for SES or socioeconomic status amongst a very educated, cohorts educated in, I would say, social, you know, high socioeconomic status, Peter. But interesting to look at. Bert, Dr. Stanford, Ted in Westminster, outstanding. Thanks so much, Bert, for being here. I'm so thankful that you were able to attend on this Sunday morning. So thanks for being here. Marilyn Evans, thanks so much for the value information. I read that there's evidence that blood type may have an effect on COVID. So the data on looking at blood type is a little bit, not robust is the word I would like to use in terms of COVID. I think that we still need more data to really look at blood types. Now, it's important for us to note also, Marilyn, when we're looking at blood type, and actually just submitted a piece with two of my Harvard College students looking at this, is that there's certain blood types, for example, that are more prevalent within certain groups. And so the blood type itself, I don't think is the issue. It may be more race, ethnic groups. So for example, if you're looking at B positive, O pos, O neg, I think are the two or three that are much more prevalent within the Black community. And so is it the blood type or is it more the race ethnicity piece? And then when we're looking at race ethnicity piece, it also becomes fuzzy because race is a social construct and not a biologic variable. So I think more to be done there, but I'm glad that you're doing good reading. And I think we'll have more to say about that in the future.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So, David Paul, how do we get more information out there? I keep giving these talks and I keep encouraging my colleagues that have this knowledge base to give these talks to the greater community to do, you know, just on Friday, I did a talk with Science Magazine about some of these issues related to COVID-19. I'll give Ted the link to that also, where we were looking at Biden's proposed $1.9 trillion plan in terms of vaccination and in terms of economic relief. But one of the things that if you look at the fine prints, or at least and the information that's widely available to the public, we don't see significant information about how this breaks down by the groups that are most disproportionately impacted by this disease process, that are higher likelihood of dying or risk for dying if contracting the disease. And so I think that, you know, the Biden administration, I think, has been thoughtful in terms of their selections, in terms of key players in the team, but there needs to be a concerted effort to address, for example, vaccine hesitancy in the Black community. Right now, depending upon which study you look at or which poll you're looking at, you know, you're seeing on the order of somewhere between 18 to 28% of Blacks that said they would take a vaccine if offered. Well, that's pretty problematic if we look at the higher risk of death, right, in terms of the population, if we go back to those bar charts that we saw. But the vaccine hesitancy, maybe that they're hearing the messaging not from people that look like myself. How do we change that? I mean, I've had people that have been very resistant, and within 2 minutes of me speaking to them, are willing to change their minds after having very strong convictions against getting a vaccine. So I think that we need to continue to get more information out there. I think we need to see more news coverage of this in the greater press. CNN, for example, is a source where people go for information. John Hayes, are there distribution schedules for vaccines cognizant of disparities of need? That's exactly, John, what I was talking about. I think that, you know, the Biden administration is talking about, right, 100 million vaccines in the first 100 days of his term. But how are we looking at it in terms of distribution, in terms of need and disparities? I have not seen the nuances that break the plan down further by looking at that issue. And so I do think they need to be mindful in that particular thought process. How does COVID impact people with autoimmune diseases? So patients, depending upon what the autoimmune disease is, we consider this chronic conditions. It appears to have some impact, but not as much as the things that you saw me raise when I was looking at Allegheny County, for example, when we looked at heart disease, we looked at kidney disease, obesity. But autoimmune compromise can lead to bad outcomes, especially if someone has an advanced course of a disease process. So for example, rheumatoid arthritis, for example. So it depends on the severity of whatever the autoimmune process and which autoimmune process, but those have borne out a little bit lower in the risk of I guess, morbidity, sickness, and mortality. Let's see, next, Donna, are there ideas, Donna, I don't know if it's Litzel, are there ideas of advocacy groups who are targeting the incarcerated communities who are being excluded from vaccination? I know the governor, and she's saying, I guess no governor in Pennsylvania has been hesitant to answer questions around this population. So this is, Donna, an important question. I can tell you that this question has come up, and there are strong position statements now out of the American Medical Association. In addition to the many hats I wear, I serve as chair of the Minority Affairs section for the entire American Medical Association, which has 270,000 physician members. And there was a resolution that passed in our House of Delegates in November of 2020 that specifically looked at making sure we prioritize those incarcerated populations. Now, whether or not the government decides to take heed to what the AMA says, you know, is always up for question. But if any group is likely to influence it, I think the AMA does have a strong voice. We do have physicians that work primarily in correctional facilities. And so they are specifically interested in that. And so I think that there's still going to be people skirting around what to do. So you'll see your governor, you'll see other governors, you'll see maybe even Biden himself, you know, struggle with answering these questions because of the taboo idea of exploring what's going on within the incarcerated population. But I think a lot of that goes back to like who's mostly likely to be incarcerated and being from racial ethnic groups.
And I want to jump in here and say that, you know, I think scripture informs us about our call to advocate for, to visit and to support people who are in prison. And we've had seminars on this subject. It's probably time for another one. But I think our faith can inform this, because in politics, it's not always popular to do this.
Oh, Donna, I see it was Litzel. So I'm sorry for saying it incorrectly, but I appreciate you for correcting me there. But your question is extremely important. Lisa Fowler says, I wonder how the age of Allegheny County, still second oldest per capita in the US, affected the data. You know, if you looked at, I really perused quite a few counties like my home county of Fulton County in Georgia, for example, you know, Suffolk County here in Boston. And, you know, there's variations amongst the theme of, you know, the age. Suffolk County residents tend to be significantly older, for example. I don't think it really affected like the chronic conditions significantly, but I do appreciate you for bringing that up, Lisa, in terms of the data that I presented, particularly from Allegheny County. I'm being mindful of who I was talking to today. Kathy Painter says obesity leads to so many negative health outcomes, yet it is frustrating to see that in the United States, more attention is paid to treating the disease after the fact instead of addressing the education and preventive disparities. I have some thoughts about this, Kathy. What kinds of changes would you like to see in our country to improve the health outcomes for all? So first of all, I hear you, Kathy. I want to acknowledge that greater than 42% of US adults already have obesity. And I think one of the major issues is that we haven't treated those people. What happens is if you look at, and I didn't present this idea or concept of fetal programming, for example, and I think the best preventive measure is to really kind of look at this idea. So fetal programming is this idea that if a mom goes into pregnancy with overweight and obesity, she then exposes the fetus, the unborn fetus, to inflammatory markers, which then leads to issues like disease, obesity, fatty liver, diabetes, this idea of hyperphagia, this insatiable desire to eat. But we know that 50% of pregnancies in the United States were unplanned. And so then how do we prevent this disease that has become so prevalent within our population? And I think that we have to target moms and dads preconception, but that means that we have to target the whole population in terms of prevention. I mean, obviously we want to focus on things like diet quality and physical activity, which are the only things we ever hear about, but we want to think about issues like medications that we as doctors prescribe to patients. Many of the medicines we prescribe cause significant amount of weight gain. We think actually it causes about 20% of the weight struggles that we see in the United States. Are drugs like lithium, Depakote, Tegretol, Celexa, Cymbalta, Effexor, Zoloft, Paxil, Ambien, Trazodone, Lunesta, Gabapentin, Glyburide, Glipizide, Lamotrigine, Esinolol, Metoprolol, Propranolol, long-term insulin, long-term prednisone, just to name a few of the meds that we can see cause significant weight gain. I've done that a few times, you guys may have noticed. So these are issues that I think about. I think about sleep quality and duration, circadian rhythm disruption, which comes with us being up at night. And Ted knows that I work often wee into the morning hours and I'm still up when he wakes up to work. And so that's probably something I don't model well for patients. I do model the other things well. So I think it has to be a conglomerate of looking at the complexity of the things that are leading to obesity and not simplifying it, but recognizing that we still have this huge population that already has the disease. And so I don't think we focus on treatment. What we do know is that only 2% of patients that meet criteria for medications for obesity in the United States get them. That means 98% that meet criteria for medications for obesity don't. Only 1% get access to bariatric surgery, so 99 don't. So I say that we don't treat the disease well. I think we do horribly with regards to the treatment of obesity, which means that it's going to affect our generations to come, right? Because those individuals that then conceive, the likelihood of you inheriting obesity from your parents is on the order of 50 to 85% likelihood, even if you do everything perfectly once they get here on this earth. So it's important for us to get the people before they're even born, which is a public health strategy that has not been entertained, probably because it's so complex and we have to target the whole population. So that's...
I'm going to jump in here because we're fast running out of time.
Yes, Steve, 2 minutes.
Stop the recording and say, thank you so much, Fatima. And